Republican National Convention and the President coming to Jacksonville, taking Confederate monuments down. One's down now. What's next? And City Council forms a Social Justice and Community Investment Committee, that rolls off the tongue, after continued protest. Just some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm A.G. Gankarski, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, our top stories on the Friday Media Roundtable. We want your calls, 549-2937, area code 904. Then later, what's happening at the baseball grounds in lieu of baseball? But first, it's Friday. And here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome WJCT's Sky LeBron. Hi, Sky.
Hey, A.G.
Emily Block of the Florida Times-Union. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
Freelance journalist Claire Goforth. Claire, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Awesome. And Fred Matthews, a regular contributor. Fred, are you here with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, AG. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Fred. I think we have a few things to talk about this week. Lots, to be exact. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Despite everything, COVID-19 is still an issue. And statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 69,069 COVID-19 cases, up by 1,698, the largest daily increase to date in the case counts since the pandemic began. The DOH reports 2,848 deaths. We have seen a total of 2,903 cases in Northeast Florida, 106 deaths. But the big story from this week is the Republican National Convention hurtling toward us even as the curb seemingly unflattens. Last night, we received confirmation that the RNC would be held in Jacksonville in just 70-some-odd days. Do we have a clip of that?
Jacksonville. I know what you're thinking. Are we big enough, bold enough to host the RNC? If you think you know Jacksonville, think again. We've got football, baseball, even hockey, world-class arts, culture, shopping, dining, beaches, breweries, and nightlife that'll change your life. We've hosted the Super Bowl, the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, and Tim McGraw. And we're home to some of the nation's greatest Fortune 500 companies. What city would take on the Republican National Convention with just 75 days to pull it off? Probably not many. But Jacksonville isn't just any city. Here in the River City, we do things big and bold, and we'll be ready.
Big and bold indeed. Jacksonville is in play for part of the event, namely the acceptance speech by President Trump, because North Carolina's Democratic governor would not allow the Republican Party to host a full-capacity event due to the pandemic. Critics of the RNC to Jacksonville move say they're worried about spreading the virus, the potential for unrest and large-scale protest. The chair of the Duval Democratic Party, Daniel Henry, says it's reckless and irresponsible. We've got a tweet here saying, why do we pay for the landing to be destroyed? The protesters that are coming to town would have done it for free. So we've got a lot of issues here, but I want to get some of our people in here talking about the GOP's announcement. Fred Matthews, let's start off with you. What were your thoughts when you heard about the announcement Thursday evening that the convention would be here?
Well, the first thing I thought about was that it sort of goes to what many non-voters say. They're going to do whatever they want to do. And this, the coming of the convention to Jacksonville, is an event that the citizens of Jacksonville, especially those who are not Republican, have absolutely nothing to say about it and can't do anything about it. It's totally in the hands of the city leadership that we elected. It will certainly be a fun time for those who enjoy conventions and listening to the speeches. I've had the pleasure of sitting in on one of the president's rallies here in Jacksonville, and it is quite a grand event. But it will entail all of the things that we're concerned about now with the coronavirus and all of that. But apparently that makes no mind, because we want to have this event here in Jacksonville. We want Jacksonville to be on the map, and the mayor and the head of the local Republican Party and the governor of the state of Florida, all of them are cheerleaders for our president, and it should be a grand old time for the GOP in Jacksonville.
Hey, thank you, Fred. Sky, I want to go to you regarding some of the logistics. You were on the mayor's press conference this morning at 7 a.m. Great time for a presser.
Seriously.
And, you know, the mayor said that local taxpayers are not really going to have to pay much for this event. They're saying that federal and state partners and all of that. Do you want to go into some of the ways that the cost might be defrayed?
Yeah, so I think one thing that is important to bring up is the concern that, you know, Mayor Curry has brought up time and time again that this is something that the city will not have to pay for, but there are major concerns when it comes to when is that reimbursement going to come? Because it's not like they just hand you a check with a bunch of money and say, here, do what you want with it. This is something that Jacksonville will have to pay for, and then they're going to hope for reimbursement dollars later down the road. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all works out, especially as we enter budget time, and there's already a lot of tighter restrictions when it comes to coronavirus and all the effects that it had. There's been a lot of programs put in place to help out small businesses and to help out different families and people affected by this. So how is this going to have a lasting effect on Jacksonville? And will it help the way that the mayor says? He said it's going to be $100 million in potential economic development and growth here.
Yeah, I mean, $100 million, that's serious money for a business sector that's been hit hard. You know, Claire, is there any potential downside to this, though?
Well, we have one of the most divisive presidents in history coming to town in the middle of hurricane season on the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday during a global pandemic in a period of historic civil unrest and record unemployment. So what could possibly go wrong? A lot could go wrong. I mean, that $100 million figure seems to be just pulled out of the thin air. I haven't really seen anything to back that up. There's no denying that there will be a boon to some business. Will that outweigh the possible public health crisis that could happen after that? The destruction that we could see if there are violent protests? I mean, Donald Trump has a lot of, there's a lot of anger towards him. And, you know, when we talk about him coming to Jacksonville, are we going to have a replay of what we saw outside the White House, where they fired tear gas into a crowd to clear the way for a photo op? I mean, nobody in Jacksonville wants to see that. We want to see peaceful protests, but I think anybody who was there on Tuesday during the demonstration after the Confederate monument was taken down from Heming Park can say that there is still a lot of anger in Jacksonville, and that anger is going to only be exacerbated by Donald Trump flying to town.
Thank you, Claire. Emily, I want to go to you. You know, obviously, we talked about Axe Handle Saturday a little bit. The Trump campaign's got a campaign event in Tulsa, Oklahoma, next Friday, Juneteenth. There were race riots there about 100 years ago that are historic and, you know, ignominious. Emily, is the city playing with fire, you know, by hosting this event?
That's the question people are asking, AG. I mean, like you said, we have an event, a rally on Juneteenth, essentially a glorified rally now on Axe Handle Saturday. So what's next? What's the next big date that's going to be appropriated by the president is what people want to know, because that's essentially what this is, right? It's the affiliated with the RNC, but all the businesses and meetings are still happening in North Carolina. So we're getting the acceptance speech. We're getting the rally, which to Claire's point, I don't know where that 100 million influx is coming from when we're getting one day of events, not a whole convention with meetings and such.
Yeah, and I want to follow up on that. You bring up a good point with the economic impact. It's not just going to be a Duval County positive impact here, is it? I mean, we don't have the hotels downtown and on the South Bank, you know, and the North Bank to actually handle this. So where are people going to stay?
Right. I mean, I'm sure that as we've seen, hotel capacity is slammed across Duval County, but also St. John's County and so on. But it's also the question of, are businesses even going to be open to accept that influx of potential dollars? We see businesses that are legally allowed to be open right now, as either at full capacity or still at half capacity, that are putting their foot down and saying they don't want to because they don't quite feel comfortable yet. So what is that going to mean in another couple months, when we're seeing everyone, another potential spike come here on, you know, the highest day since we've started reporting COVID cases.
Yeah, you know, these are big issues. And, you know, we're getting emails from people. Andy writes, the most important thing to remember is that Lenny Curry and Ron DeSantis alone are completely responsible for all the bad things that are sure to happen as a result of this convention coming to our city. Email from Marilyn, Charlotte cares about protecting GOP from the virus. What does that say about Jax? A hurricane could change plans. You know, in hurricane season, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. But we know with the virus, at least at the Tulsa event next week, they've got sort of a prenup agreement where you sign off saying, if I get COVID here, I hold you all harmless. So, you know, we're seeing that even as there's not worry about the virus in terms of the planning, there's worry in terms of contractual you know, obligations. We got a couple people on hold. The phone lines are lit. I want to go to John first. John, you're on the air. You're from Avondale. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is, who's going to be paying for the security that's going to be involved with the convention? The Trump Organization has a habit of not paying what they should be paying. And when cities start asking for money in advance because they owe other cities and are not paying, then the Trump administration is offended by that. I'll take the answer online.
Hey, thank you, John. Sky, you know, we talked about that a little bit of the show, but the mayor's confident, right?
Yeah, he says he's confident according to the press conference, and he says that it's going to turn out to be a positive, but I mean, there's a track record, right? And from previous events that the Trump administration and the White House have put on, there has been hold on money that should be going to these cities, and they're still questioning and wondering when that money is going to be coming, especially when it comes to security, because obviously JSO is going to be overwhelmed, but they need to bring in extra security. That's going to be a lot of expenses, especially because now we're living in a pretty volatile time where there's a lot going on, and we can expect a lot more to be going on in August. So you bring up a great question, and I don't know if we have an answer to that just yet.
Yeah, I mean, Claire, you've looked at the national protests and you've seen that it's not just National Guard. I mean, there are Bureau of Prison Guards and other supplementary forces that have been brought in security-wise. Is that something you think the city is ready for?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, we're going to see a lot of, it's going to be a very tense time already, and that is only going to heighten the pressure. And, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about since this announcement is, you know, logistically, ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena is right across from where the Hart Bridge ramps are coming down, and there is a lot going on downtown that probably doesn't put Jacksonville, doesn't give us a good look, shall we say. You know, there's an idea behind the mayor's promotional video that this is going to showcase our city in a positive way. But is it going to showcase our city in a positive way if all these visitors come from across the country and they're in the middle of a construction zone in a city that is incredibly angry? I mean, how many people have signed that petition to keep the RNC from coming here? As of yesterday, it was 15,000. So there's going to be protests, there's going to be a lot of emotion, and then we have sort of rubble surrounding the event. I don't know if that's the way we want to be showcased on the national stage.
Okay, yeah. You know, and Fredo, I want to get you in here on this Axe Handle Saturday anniversary. You know, it's the 60th anniversary is going to overlap with this RNC event. Donald Trump, a divisive figure. He's made, you know, countless racially polarizing comments. Is this going to be seen as provocative?
Well, of course it's going to be seen as provocative, but only by those persons who are concerned about Axe Handle Sunday. And only about from those persons who know that the event will be held less than a quarter mile from one of the poorest neighborhoods in Jacksonville, Florida, the East Side. There is absolutely no concern for that by the persons who are putting this on. The mayor is not tone deaf. The governor is certainly not tone deaf by touting Jacksonville. There's a reason, obviously, why it didn't go to Miami. Tampa didn't want it. And you know, they can't go down to Miami. And they can't go to Fort Lauderdale, the Palm Beach, where the president has his mansion. So they're simply, this is something that they wanted to do. These have been, the mayor, as we all know, former state Republican chairman, longtime involved in this. He gave a full-throated endorsement of Trump during the election. There's no, they could care less about, this is one of those issues in which truly the mayor of the city could care less about what half of the population thinks or wants or any petition that's being put in forth. This is about furthering their own political means and desires, and again bowing down to what is the emperor of the Republican Party and giving him the show that he wants. Look, as far as security is concerned, what do you think all of those tanks and riot gear and all of that stuff came from less than a few weeks ago here in Jacksonville downtown? We've never seen anything like that before. You're going to see that in protection of the ViStar Arena when this convention takes up, and it's going to be taken care of. This is an event, folks, in which the citizens have absolutely nothing to say about it. You could say it's unfortunate, but again, we get the government that we vote for. There are 40,000 more registered Democrats in Duval County than there are Republicans, 134,000 non-party affiliated persons. But unfortunately, they either voted for the Republican leadership or they stayed home.
Hey, thank you, Fred. I want to read an email here from a registered Republican named Scott. I disagree with the convention being moved to our city. It is irresponsible and selfish for our leaders to be opening up our state this way at that crucial time in the fight against pandemic. Please don't lump all Republicans together and think we all support this president and his continued poor judgment. Got another email from Catherine, who says that Lenny Curry doesn't care at all about the people of Jacksonville. He hired Aaron Zahn for JEA, and now he stepped up to make our town vulnerable to the virus and riots. He is only about his own future political aspirations and greasing the wheel. A lot of criticism coming in. I want to take a couple calls. We got Jack from Intercoastal West. Jack, you're on First Coast Connect.
Morning, AG. Morning, Emily, and everyone else on the panel. I just want to say that, I had so many fears about the RNC cut, but, when the mayor said that we once hosted Tim McGraw concert, I swear it made all my worries go away. But on a serious note, I think it's really disappointing to see that the convention's coming out here. I was on the show yesterday saying that, it's seeing another time where the mayor's putting personal and political gain over public safety. And it's a long pattern of it. And I think that in those previous two emails you're talking about mentioned that. And I think if this doesn't cause people in Jacksonville to question the mayor's position and whether or not he should be allowed by the electorate to finish out his term, I personally think nothing will.
So you're suggesting a recall?
Yes, I've been supporting it honestly for a couple months now, but this feels almost like a bridge too far to the point in which you've gone beyond just putting the city's financial future or the future of the children of the city at risk as he has previously, and now you're putting the immediate future of the city at danger by bringing in tens of thousands of people into the city and creating just the perfect situation for Jacksonville to become the next COVID hotspot.
Okay. Thank you for your call. We got a lot of people on hold. I'm going to Jack in Fernandina Beach now. Jack, you seem to have a beef with the convention placement. Go ahead.
Well, not with the convention placement, but with one of the comments by one of your panel that mentioned Jacksonville and St. Augustine as hotel places, but we've got fine hotel places on Amelia Island, which would be probably closer to the convention site than would places be from St. Augustine.
Okay, Jack, let me ask you a question here. You're not from Duval County, but Duval County is going to be shouldering the burden of paying for this event. But, you know, obviously the ancillary economic benefits are going to Nassau, St. John's, et cetera. Do you think that's fair? Or do you think the outlying county should pitch in on this?
Depends.
Depends on what?
Well, the convention is being held in Nassau County. I'm sorry, Duval County.
Yes, sir.
And we just, the only thing that we're going to benefit from is probably the hotel motel tax that's going to be generated from it.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your call. We need to move on. It's a very
fair point.
Yeah, it is. Go ahead.
About the hotels.
Yeah, go ahead, Claire.
Yeah, I was going to say that is a fair point about whether or not the surrounding counties should shoulder some of the burden if Jacksonville is going to have to pony up some money. I mean, the mayor says that we're not going to have to, but that remains to be seen. But, I mean, the reality is, as the caller said, that honestly, the Ritz and the Omni are they're enormous hotels in Nassau County that are also very luxurious, shall we say, and would probably be preferable to some of Jacksonville's. I mean, Jacksonville has fine hotels as well, but we're talking oceanfront, gorgeous hotels. I mean, you can certainly see that there may be a significant influx of people who stay there, and yet then Nassau County is only going to get the benefit of the cost that people pay for their rooms and also the tax, and that money is not going to come to Duval. Same with St. John's County. So there's a fair question of whether or not the outlying counties should participate in some form financially to subsidize the cost, even if it's just their business community donating to that that nonprofit that they started to raise funds.
Hey, thank you, Claire. I want to take one more call on this. We got Chuck from the Beaches, and we've had a lot of negative comments on this show, and I think Chuck wants to offer a corrective. Go ahead, you're on the line.
Hey, guys. If you remember, I believe it was in 68, the Democratic convention in Chicago. You can always have bad things happen, but the commentary that you guys have been given this morning has pretty much all been negative. I wonder if a week ago and yesterday Joe Biden had said the Democratic convention was coming to Jacksonville. As a Republican, I would think that's a great thing. This is America. I will not be protesting at any Democratic convention like happened in 68, and I hope that people would have the courtesy to let the Republicans have a convention anywhere they want in America and have the courtesy to let it happen. And if Joe Biden and the Democrats want to come to Jacksonville, I kind of get the impression that your conversation would be a little different.
Okay. Thank you. There was a thing that DeSantis kept saying at press conferences, which is if the Democrats wanted a convention in Florida, he'd welcome that too. And I think Mayor Curry said something similar, however, take it with a grain of salt. We need to move on. It's been a busy week. You know, Confederate monuments, that's another big topic. We've got one down already. There's more to go. On early Tuesday morning, local TV news showed a crane hauling out the 122-year-old Confederate monument from Heming Park. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry said that, you know, the rest were coming down. They're going to basically take these things down. Curry marched with Black Lives Matter protesters, but, you know, he heard that the changes proposed were just a down payment on justice. I've got somebody who's been waiting online now to talk about monuments, Rebecca from Lakewood. Rebecca, you're on First Coast Connect. Good morning.
I felt that the timing of the monuments, the whole thing, and now with the announcement of the RNC coming, it just felt like a hollow gesture, and it was meant to by the goodwill of the people, because he knew this was coming. And it just sort of, you know, like I think that Nate Monroe said in his column, it was, you know, one step forward, two steps back, made it all the more disappointing, because I just felt that it made that look calculated, the whole tearing down of the monument, which, you know, so I was happy for like one day. And then this announcement, or the speculation about the announcement, came. That was my first comment. And if you don't mind, I was going to make another quick comment.
Go ahead.
Yeah. That about Tommy Hazzouri's quote in the Washington Post, where he was supportive of the decision and said that, you know, he hopes that it works. And he says, I trust that the mayor is doing all the necessary homework. And I don't know. I mean, really, he trusts that the mayor is doing this? Like, on what basis? The JEA fiasco, or maybe the school board's half-cent sales tax debacle? Yeah. Wondering what he's basing that on.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for your call. Yeah, I want to get the panel in on this because, you know, this is a hot topic. And, you know, Fred, I'm going to start with you on the Confederate monument thing. Obviously, you know, that's been in Hemming for 122 years. We've had monuments around since the Jim Crow era to uphold Jim Crow ideologies. You know, give me some of your historical context on the monuments coming down and whether it is a gesture that's been undermined by the RNC recruitment.
Well, I can't really say that it's been undermined by it. For groups like Take 'em Down Jacksonville and Ben Frazier's Northside Coalition, this is something they've been yelping and crying and marching about for several years now. This is a low-hanging fruit for the mayor to do as a gesture. It's easy. I mean, the city council could have certainly passed the resolutions that Anna Lopez Broche had put forth a couple of years ago, but they refused to do it. The mayor basically ignored it and didn't want to get involved in it because he didn't see anything in it for him. So this is a nice gesture to take down the monument down there. I mean, who's it going to really hurt? And you know, that's where it comes down to. The real issues that everybody's talking about is the issues of economic equality and, of course, the police force getting a much more transparent police force than we have here with Mike Williams. And that is something that the mayor is not willing to wade into strongly enough. Neither, unfortunately, is the state attorney's office willing to do more than give us words at this point. But the monuments, it certainly is a good thing for those of us who've had to live with that, watching the traitors get their day. But for many Americans, they see these as trying to rewrite history. And that is what basically happens from time to time. History does get rewritten. Plessy versus Ferguson was rewritten. The fact that you had poll taxes, that was rewritten. So this is no different than anything else, but you can't say that, you know, it's not something that you don't want. It is something that has been asked for, and it apparently is going to be done.
Okay. Thank you, Fred. Emily, I want to get you in on this. There's a petition right now to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School. There are a lot of things in Jacksonville that are named after Confederate alumni. What's the process going to be like? It's easy to take down a statue, take down a historical plaque, et cetera. But the renaming process, is that a bit more fraught with difficulty?
Yes, absolutely. And the school board doesn't have a lot to comment on it right now. I'm working on a story about this, actually. But they say, keep an eye out, keep watching. It's definitely a lot more of a process. Taking a statue down, the mayor didn't even have to loop in the council members, as we saw. He was able to make that call since it's on public property, park property. The 11 monuments and markers that we see are coming down on that list are all on public property, a lot of park property again. But something like a street name involves a lot more businesses. Something like a school name involves a lot more process and protocol. So it's a lot lengthier of a process, and it's not something I think Take 'em Down Jacksonville is going to let up on, but it will probably take longer and a lot more pressure and a lot more bureaucracy.
Yeah, I mean, the renaming of schools, the last prominent example we had was the renaming of Forest High School, named after Grand Wizard of Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century. It was renamed to Westside High School, and that was 2013. And even that renaming was controversial. It was a political football for a few years, and the fact that we're talking about it in retrospect illustrates that it's history. It does happen. It just takes time. Claire, I want to get you in here because you were at the protest with me. We marched with the mayor. Could you describe some of what you saw? Because you were taking photographs and you have a keen eye. So, give us some detail.
Well, I think what was expected by the mayor's office was going to be this like very positive photo opportunity with people feeling very happy. And there certainly was a sense of celebration among some in the crowd that the monument had finally come down. But there was also a lot of simmering anger towards JSO, the state attorney's office, and the mayor. I mean, at one point he was surrounded by protesters chanting, no justice, no peace, no racist police. It was a very, a moment of mixed emotions in the crowd. In the end, the mayor kind of, he left, I would say, maybe not prematurely, but let's just say that his exit was rapid. As people were shouting at him with his back against the wall at City Hall. At that point, by that time, Mike Williams was nowhere to be seen, the sheriff. It's a symbolic gesture. It's been asked for a long time. And while people are very glad about it, there are some questions about the fact that while thousands of locals have wanted something, it took a football player, much credit to Chris Conley, for the impassioned speech that he delivered to take that monument down, and also credit to the mayor for taking action on this finally. But it's symbolism. It's not change. And people want both. They want the economic disparity actually addressed in a meaningful way. They want JSO to be more transparent and to alter its policies about use of force, and for the racial disparity in arrests and incarceration to be significantly overhauled. So, I mean, it was you could feel all of that in the crowd. All of that, and you could hear it in people's voices and see it in their faces. So hopefully this is the first step towards some serious changes that are long overdue.
549-2937 for your calls. Emily, I want to get you in here on this, because what we're seeing are leaders in their late 40s, early 50s trying to reckon with a generational change, I think. Because it seems like that the generations coming up and protesting, people in their 20s, early 30s, teens, have radically different expectations of what government should do, what law enforcement should do, the relationship of people to the state, than people of older generations. Is that coming into play here? Is that something that the mayor, the sheriff, the state attorney are going to have to tackle?
Absolutely. And I think they are recognizing that, the mayor, the sheriff, like they're seeing that. And that's why they're trying to start inviting younger voices to their panels, to their roundtable discussions. We're seeing it a lot more. We're seeing a lot of Gen Z voices that are coming to these rallies, protests, oftentimes organizing them. And that's not to say that the longtime protesters aren't there right beside them, but I think there's a palpable shift in the demand. It's not, and we're seeing that in the narrative nationally as well, it's not so enough to be colorblind anymore. And I think a lot of Gen Z that I'm talking to are telling me about having to explain that to their parent, that being colorblind isn't good anymore, that you have to be anti-racist is what they're trying to explain to their parents and to public officials as well. So we're seeing those narratives come up through our city.
Yeah, I mean, the image that stuck with me from Tuesday was Mayor Curry walking with a mask with protesters yelling through megaphones at him and him just silent. It was a remarkable visual for me personally because, this mayor has projected power for year after year after year, but the tables were turned on Tuesday in a meaningful way. We're seeing some movement in the state attorney's office this morning. WJXT reported Folio Weekly also had something along the lines that after reviewing video of protest and arrest downtown May 30th and 31st, charges against 48 people accused of unlawful assembly have been dropped. So that's a positive sign for those peaceful protesters. Another positive sign also, we've got, the city council forming the new Social Justice Community Investment Committee. Incoming council president Tommy Azuri said this week that, the city's entering a new era of enlightenment. Mayor Curry, Sheriff Williams, State Attorney Nelson, All these people were on it. The committee itself that Herzuri is setting up is going to have 7 council members chaired by Brenda Priestley Jackson and Matt Carlucci, the rules and finance chairs. Fred, I want to get you in here. You've seen the number of committees in the city over the years. What will Brenda Priestley Jackson and Matt Carlucci bring to the table that might make this one more relevant?
Well, see, legal background. And, of course, Brenda has a deep history in this community. Her father was a longtime member and leader of the local NAACP. And of course, her and her husband have served, served on the school board. Her husband was an employee of the school board. Her children have all come through the system here. And her, movement into the city council was almost preordained after the Terrence Freeman debacle. I think that she will add a pretty good voice for her Northside District 10 on that city council. She has, she has become even a voice of reason in many times over the last year or so. For the issues that the council has been faced with, particularly on the school board bond issue. So it's an interesting turn of events. She was not obviously on the same page with Bowman, Councilman Bowman and those, as we know now from the tweets that have been going on. So I think that she's on a much better page with Tommy Herzuri, who again knows these people. He's a known entity. They know him. So we should see some change going about. The key here will be the committee, this I guess will be civilian committee that they've been talking about, that will look at the economic things that need to happen for the north side of Jacksonville in particular, north and west side of Jacksonville in particular. So it should be an interesting time over the next 6 months. The key, however, will be the same thing. How much of what they develop in the council will the mayor be agreeing with? Because Brenda Priestley Jackson and those do not have that relationship with the mayor. All of that will fall on Tommy Herzuri to get done.
Yeah, and there's one quote that jumped out at me. What we are focused on is eradicating the vestiges of systemic and institutional bias, which really reflects uncoded maybe racism and social inequity in Jacksonville. Claire, have you heard this sort of language from council before?
Well, I mean, no criticism to the city council, but another committee? Do we need another committee to know what is wrong in Jacksonville with racial disparity? We've had the study, the racial disparity study from years ago that had a series of recommendations that were largely, if not entirely, ignored. We have so many voices, including people on council, who can tell you in a matter of a minute all of the things that Jacksonville needs to do to really correct this longstanding racial bias in business, in justice, in law. These are not secrets, and we'll see another committee that will say the same things. And then, as you said, what will happen afterwards? I mean, the reality is it takes a long time to affect sea change of this nature. But it's also true that these exact same changes have been promised for 50 years, since consolidation and beyond, most likely. And we have seen limited effort. I think that a lot of people are hopeful that with what is all going on in the United States and in Jacksonville today, that is we're at the precipice of a very deep and lasting change that many would say is long overdue. But it remains to be seen. And will a committee by itself affect that? No, of course not. But at least it's something, I suppose. I mean,
yeah,
that's really all I got on that.
Oh, that's very optimistic. I want to move on to HRO. We could have used 2 hours today, guys. But, the Human Rights Ordinance passed again 15-4 on Tuesday. The vote was cure legislation to fix defects in how the 2017 bill was passed. The appeals court kicked it back. This bill asks protections based, you know, banning discrimination based on gender identity, sexual orientation, the four no votes for council conservatives. Emily, I want to get you in here on this. You know, Jacksonville taking until the last few years to get LGBT legislation. You know, and then they got this through. Will this close the chapter on this issue in the city?
I don't think so. And that's, of course, a personal opinion. But based on the voices that I'm hearing, the people that supported this bill, even the people that did not support this bill, it was the same argument that happened 3 years ago when this was first brought up. So the fact that we're in this time warp and facing the same questions, the same criticisms, even the same no votes. Councilman Ferraro, when he first voted no on this bill, cited that it would hurt businesses. This law has now been basically in action for 3 years, and I haven't seen any examples of businesses being hurt, but still it was a no vote from Ferraro. And that's not to single him out. There were four members in total that voted no for it. And we're seeing repeats. So I don't know how much of a push forward this will be, because I feel like we've been here before. We've seen this before, and readers are telling me the same, that we've seen this tree, we've seen that bush. So what's the difference now?
Okay. You know, Fred, I want to get you in here. We're running short on time, so maybe in about a minute. This HRO repassage, what does it say about the city and its changes?
I think that they've come to a realization that it does not affect their financial well-being, which is all in this city the first thing that they look at. How will it affect us financially? It will not be detrimental to that. It's a good thing to change the climate that has to do with discrimination and making sure that all persons are created equal and can work and live and play in this city on an equal basis. So it's a good thing. It is well past due.
Okay. We're running short on time. So I want to thank everybody on the panel. You know, Fred Matthews, always great. Claire Goforth, Emily Block. Sky LeBron is actually en route to a press conference, so that's why I haven't heard from him in a minute. You know, when we get back from break, we're going to hear about what's happening at the baseball grounds. You know, baseball season isn't happening right now, but there's plenty of activity, and we're going to get into that after the break. So stay tuned.
Hungary and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congaryandpenn.com for more information.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Is your business suffering because of coronavirus? Your insurance policy may already provide coverage. Not sure how to tell? Learn more at terrellhogan.com.
One Florida Clinical Research Consortium is looking for essential workers in healthcare to join the HERO Registry and help researchers at the University of Florida and nationwide understand what their experience is like on the front lines of COVID-19. Nurses, food service workers, respiratory therapists, environmental service workers, long-term care facility workers, emergency responders, and other clinical and non-clinical personnel can join online at heroesresearch.org.
Houston, America, and the world, remember.
Go on and get your rest now. We gonna fight on. We gonna fight on. We gonna fight on.
Cities and Congress come under pressure to clean up the police, and Georgia's primary, well, that was a hot mess. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Maybe your inner voice has gotten noisier these days. Music helps center you. It quiets your thoughts, takes you to new places. You might even hear your own experience in lyrics from an old favorite or even a song you've just discovered. Listen while staying in or take us with you wherever you go. Stay connected with WJCT. Call us now at 353-9528 or visit us online at WJCT.org. And thank you.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp may not be able to play ball right now due to the coronavirus pandemic, but they are cooking up all sorts of socially distanced experiences for their fans. Right now, we've got Jumbo Shrimp Executive Vice President and General Manager Harold Craw on the line. Harold Craw, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks for joining us and telling us about all the stuff happening at the baseball grounds. First of all, why don't you tell us about this weekend's event? What's going on?
So we're excited. Obviously, this is our second movie night that we'll be showing tomorrow night here at the 121 Financial Ballpark. We're showing Good Burger based on the fan vote, which was so much fun to enjoy and watch the banter back and forth between our selections. I was a personal fan of Minions, but the public spoke, and Good Burger it is.
Yeah, I mean, in politics, obviously, there are lobbyists pushing for certain outcomes, but in this, it's just a straight-up people voting, so you got to go with the voice of the people. Exactly. After this weekend, what else do you have coming up? Because it's going to be a busy summer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. For us, we've focused in on Father's Day weekend and with a myriad of events, you know, inside the ballpark, but also externally with the opportunity that we've reopened Scampi's Kitchen for round two. As we did on Memorial Day, we've made some deliveries out in the community, but for Father's Day, we had to switch it up a little bit because we'll have multiple events going on at the ballpark. So we are offering people the opportunity to call in and order one of our food packages for that Father's Day weekend. We are also inside our stadium on Saturday evening doing a dinner on the diamond with a higher-end plated meal inside our ballpark, and it's just going to be a fantastic evening and just a great opportunity to come out to the ballpark and do what a lot of people don't have the opportunity to do, which is eat dinner on the field. We're going to follow that up on Sunday with two separate events. In the morning, a brunch. So a brunch for Father's Day, obviously shrimp and grits, along with a couple of other options that we have for the brunch style menu. And then once you finish with your brunch, you know, dads and the folks, the family that they come with will have an opportunity to run the bases. So how cool is that on Father's Day? And then in the evening, we're doing a cookout, if you will. So we are selling packages for you to come in, very inexpensive. You know, the Father's Day cookout is $10 to $15 from an option choice, and you get, you know, an opportunity to have a meal here, more cookout style, ballpark style, with your hot dogs, with your hamburgers, with your sausage, and then be able to play catch in our outfield. And so we try to jam-pack the weekend with a bunch of activities, obviously, from the base running to the catch on the field to the setup inside the stadium, all set up to be distanced and keep those apart. Obviously, there are areas in the stadium where it's a little bit tighter, which is why we encourage folks to wear masks as well as our obviously staff, all wearing masks as we enjoy our events. Which it, the toughest thing about wearing a mask is how do you communicate that smile? Because we communicate our joy through smiles and welcoming people to the ballpark. That's one of the hurdles we've had to get over these first couple events.
Yeah, there's a lot of joy at the ballparks. There's also horror, apparently. You got a horror movie series of Friday Night Frights, Night from the Living Dead, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Plan 9 from Outer Space. What went into the selection of this? You got 500 attendees. That's capped capacity. What went into that? That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was an idea. So we know that for baseball, our focus and our mission is affordable family fun, and that's what we are about and will continue to be about. But with not having games going on, it's an opportunity to kind of every now and then take a look at how we can draw from maybe a different demo or focus on that. And we got some great feedback from some of our partners, but also people that came to the first movie night about, hey, would you consider showing maybe an action movie or maybe a horror movie or something along those lines?
Yeah, you get the Ed Wood in there.
Right? Right? So we took a little bit different look, and I know a lot of people like some of those older or movies, ironically. I'm a huge fan of some of those movies as well, and so it's a great opportunity for us to draw maybe a different group of fans and maybe some of our fans that came to the other movie nights to come into the ballpark. So
real quick, because we got about a half a minute left, how do I get tickets?
Gotcha. Just log on to our website, www.jackshrimp.com, and you'll see the link right there. We're focused right now on all of our Father's Day events. Movie night, you can log on and buy tickets there. The other events, as we drop those links in, we'll promote that information as well. And so things are coming fast and furious, and so as soon as we get that information on, we push that information out, and we encourage folks to buy tickets.
Yeah, that's exciting, and I'm sure there's going to be more stuff rolled out this summer. You all really adjusted. I want to thank you for coming on the program today. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Well, that's our program for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is the great Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm A.G. Gankarski, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville, and we'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. But if you missed anything, listen to rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or find the show at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.